Good morning. We'll call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water for a informational hearing, which I will open. We're covering a couple of topics today. Speakers are by invitation. They're listed on your agendas. I know that Representative Smith is on his way but stuck in traffic. I don't know if anybody else got caught in an I-5 mess. Maybe it, I did not, but maybe it followed us. We'll try to get him by phone. For those folks who are here also to join the Senate committee this afternoon, the time for that has been shifted to 11 o'clock. So if you were planning to, if you were invited to testify not only in this committee this morning, but in the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, should have received an email noting that the time for that has been changed due to the Senate floor session. So check your emails, but it's scheduled for 11 o'clock.
11 in this room.
11 o'clock in this room for Senate Environment and Natural Resources. We're going to begin with the informational meeting on Boardman Power Plant closure options, and Dave Robertson, Bob Jenks, and Janet Gastelum. Okay. Come on up.
She's going to transfer.
Okay.
Ringing? No, it's not doing anything.
So, Mr. Robertson, we'll start with you, and we've allotted about half an hour to this conversation, maybe 5 to 10 minutes, Dave, and then we'll hear from Bob and Jana as well. I would suggest to the committee members, if we have sort of clarifying questions as they go, let's interrupt them with that, and but then save kind of the bulk of our discussion until we've heard from the entire panel.
Okay.
We'll certainly kick it off with you.
Technical question, do I need to do anything with the slides, PowerPoint slides? Or
I will get it turned on.
You're taking it on? Okay. Thanks a lot. I wasn't missing something there.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks very much for the chance to be here today to talk to you a little bit about our Boardman 2020 plan. My name is Dave Robertson. I'm Vice President of Public Policy for Portland General Electric. We really do appreciate the time to check in with you on this. I've got a few slides to walk you through. We'll have hard copies for you at the end of the presentation.
And I think we have them here.
Oh, you already?
Yeah.
Good. I'll go ahead and try to hit some high notes because we only have 5 minutes, and there are definitely more than 5 minutes worth of slides here.
And I would say 5 to 10, Dave, in this presentation, with some time for follow-up.
So real briefly, we've basically just issued a proposal a couple of weeks ago to move the Boardman plant's closure date up to 2020. And we're going to cease operating as a coal plant in the year 2020, as opposed to installing about $500 million worth of pollution control equipment and operating through the year 2040 and beyond. We really believe this is the most sustainable option for us from the standpoint of cost to customers. We'll save about $612 million over if we had to shut the plant in 2014. For customers, it's most sustainable from an environmental standpoint. It actually results in an aggregate reduction in pollution over installing the controls and continuing to operate till 2040. And it'll be at least a 60% reduction in carbon as well over that 20 years from 2020 to 2040. And then on a social basis, it's also sustainable because it provides an orderly transition for about 110 workers at the plant and their families, as well as to the local community out there in the Boardman area in Morrow County. I'll move this over to you, don't I? Doing all right? Okay, thanks. That first slide you've got there is one that shows our load and resource forecast. This is a slide that we use in a number of different forums. Basically, this is to provide you with some context for what our needs are and why we're talking about Boardman at all. What we do at the Utility Commission, working with all of our customer groups and stakeholders, is look at what the power needs are going forward. And this is a chart that shows going forward the power generating resources that we have and the gap that we have to try to fill. And so if you look at the blue line...
And do you want to... I think the computer...
Oh, can I actually...
Yeah, I think you can control that now.
Come on, get over here. That's not what I wanted to do. Let's see.
If you go to slideshow.
Where's slideshow? Right there. Oh, there it is. Sorry. Thanks, Margie. You're a good staffer there, Margie. Thank you. let's go right. There we go. Thanks. All right.
So what you're looking at here is a slide that shows the resources that we have and what the need's going to be, and then the gap, the resources we need to actually acquire to make sure that we keep the lights on for our customers. So the blue line shows what our loads will be after we include energy efficiency. If we didn't have energy efficiency, the loads would be and the demand for power would be at the black dotted line. The white space in between all the bars below is basically the gap we have to fill. It's the power we need to either to purchase or plants we need to build to try to make sure that we're meeting our customers' needs for power. In right now, we've got about a 400 megawatt gap, and you can see by the year 2030, we'll be at about 1,600 megawatts. One quick thing to note, two things to note. On renewables, that reflects us meeting the 25% by the year 2025 renewable energy standard that the state legislature enacted in the year 2007. It also includes energy efficiency, as I mentioned before, and the loss of some hydropower contracts. We've got long-term contracts, 50-year contracts that are coming due over the next several years with the Mid-Columbia dams up in Washington State, and they're going to use the power now for load in their own service territory. That's an unfortunate thing, but we're going to be losing that. And the gap actually gets bigger when we close the Boardman plant. So there's going to be more of a bump in that 2020 time frame around the middle of the chart when we lose the Boardman plant. So switching to the Boardman plant, the next slide actually shows you just a little bit of history about the Boardman, a little bit of a few stats about it. It's about a 585 megawatt plant, and we own 65% of that. So about 380 megawatts go for PG customers. It's 15% of PG's power on an average basis. We got, like I mentioned earlier, about 110 workers at the plant, 30 who are contractors, so really 140. And then on a seasonal basis, we'd shut the plant down for maintenance, and we have about 225 people that come out for that. On the next slide, how this all really got going was the DEQ had some rules come down from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that said that they need to control haze-causing pollutants from power plants. And the Boardman plant was the first plant that the DEQ developed a rule on regarding how we should reduce those haze-causing pollutants. And what that rule said was you need to install $500 million worth of new pollution control equipment, or you need to shut the plant in 2014. That rule kind of posed a bit of a conundrum for us. Back in the process of developing that rule, we had actually a couple of options emerged in the discussions for that would help us try to manage the unknown cost of carbon reduction and carbon legislation that was coming forward. So we had proposed a 2020 closure and a 2029 closure with various levels of installation of pollution controls. Those two options, the 2020 and 2029, were not selected, so we were left with either shut in 2014 or install all the controls and operate till 2040. A number of our customer groups and environmental groups asked us to go back and look at the 2020 date, even though DEQ said no. So this last few months we've done that and gone back at it, we do believe, as I mentioned earlier, it's the best option for customers from a cost and a risk basis.
Just a few more minutes, Dave. I know there's a lot to cover here.
So 2020 is getting to 2020 is going to be tough. There are a lot of challenges. We've got to get an EPA rule approval in D.C. on a new set of air pollutants they want to control. We've got to get the DEQ to reconsider its 2040 rule and approve the 2020 rule. We also need to have the Utility Commission approve 2020 or acknowledge 2020 as a legitimate path to go down. So we've got a number of pretty big hurdles, and we're going to be pursuing those over the next several months. If we can't get there, what our analysis shows is that the next best option for us to make sure that we're keeping the lights on and doing it at the least cost and risk to customers is to go with the 2040 plan. So a couple of slides, if you move to slide 7, is kind of the summary slide, if you want to just kind of stick with that one for a minute. The whole sort of my lead-in is summarized here for you guys. The slide after that, the last thing I'll say here, just shows the amount of dollars that would be saved under various scenarios or that it would cost under various scenarios. Comparing the 2014 date with the 2020 date, comparing the 2014 date with the 2040 date, and comparing 2040 with 2020. And what you can see here is that 2014 ends up being the most expensive. 2040 is more expensive than 2020, and this really shows that the financial sweet spot for this project is the 2020 closure date. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it back to you so that you can hear from others.
Yeah, let's hear from the others. And I appreciate you being here, Mr. Robertson, and know, you know, just how many, you know, years of work goes into this type of analysis, and recognize that, you know, spending 7 minutes here in committee hardly begins to do it justice. But I do want to hear from our other guests and then see what kinds of questions members of the committee have. Thank you. Mr. Jenks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We've been talking to PGE about Boardman now for a couple years. We got real concerned during the DEQ rulemaking that it was leading towards a path of acquiring a huge investment in the plant, $500 million, that customers would have to pay. Leading scientists, climate scientists, are talking about the need to phase out coal plants over the next 20 years, asking customers to put $500 million into a pulverized coal plant with what we know about climate science and likely climate regulation and pressures on coal plants could be asking people to put money into something that simply won't last that long. We're skeptical that in this day and age you can assume you can run a plant until 2040. So we started talking with PGE about it. PGE did submit the 2020 plan to DEQ as a sort of a proposal to have a whole set of options in the rule. DEQ rejected that, but DEQ did invite PGE to reapply with a different closure date. Said under 2040, these are the rules you have to live up to. These are the controls you got to put in. But if you're not closing it in 2040, if you're closing it some other time, well, we have to take into account the cost effectiveness of the controls and the life of the plant. So if the life of the plant is shorter, you'll get a different answer. So we got real concerned after that PGE was proposing 2040. DEQ was open to something in a shorter time period. DEQ was open to 2020, potentially. PGE's analysis had said that might be the best result for customers, but nobody was pursuing it. So CUB, along with a couple other organizations, last fall sent a letter to PGE and asked PGE to put the 2020 plan back on the table, to do the analysis, get it into the resource planning of what would happen if you closed the plant in 2020 and avoided that $500 million investment. PGE, to its credit, did that analysis. Not only did they do that analysis, but they concluded after doing the analysis that was the best option for customers. So we were very encouraged. Again, we had asked PGE to look at 2020, and they came back and said, not only are we going to put the analysis out there for people to pick at, but we think that's the right plan. And so from this point forward, it's going to go to the PUC. There's some folks who have said, what about other dates? The PUC looks at things under a least cost, least risk basis. It's the good thing about the PUC is it's based on a technical analysis. Once PGE gets its plan before the PUC, we can all look at it, look at the numbers, look at alternatives, and try to determine what it really is. Is this the best plan or not? But at this point, we're looking at phasing the plan out rather than investing $500 million of customer money in it. And to me, that's a win for the environment. It's a win for ratepayers. It'll lead to lower costs better environmental results. So we're very encouraged by where we stand today.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Jenks. Ms. Costello.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastam, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Environmental Council. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the impending plans to close the Boardman Power Plant. The Oregon Environmental Council has appreciated being a part of a stakeholder dialogue series with Portland General Electric and looks forward to continuing this conversation. We commend PGE's announcement for an early closure of its Boardman Coal Power Plant, which will positively benefit Oregon. The plant currently lacks many modern air pollution controls, which will be expensive to add in full, and none of these controls will contain the greenhouse gases that are contributing to climate change. PGE recently presented a plan to close Boardman by 2020 based on least cost, least risk analysis. However, this plan only presented data for a few points in time rather than a year-by-year review. We appreciate this initial presentation of data and have encouraged our colleagues at PGE to transparently present the full range of data, including impacts on CO2 emissions, for the years 2014 through 2019. Without full information and consistent analysis, it's difficult to assess whether or not 2020 really is the best closure option, especially as we weigh public health and environmental considerations. What is clear, however, is that an early closure of Boardman, Oregon's most carbon-intensive power source, will go a long way towards helping the state meet its obligation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 10% below 1990 levels by 2020. Boardman produces roughly 4.3 million metric tons of CO2 per year, similar to emissions from 800,000 cars, and is the state's single largest emission source. Transitioning away from coal before 2020 is also a responsible course of action for PGE, as the company manages risks for the ratepayers and shareholders, and it is undoubtedly good for the climate. Another key issue in these discussions will be PGE's plan for replacement power. Any plan should use energy efficiency and renewable energy to the fullest potential. The plan for replacement power should include an analysis of environmental impacts, including greenhouse gas impacts, of the replacement energy. Natural gas will likely have a role to play, but should not be assumed to replace coal at 100%. Air pollution from Boardman does need to be addressed. Boardman currently emits SO2 and NOx, two ingredients in acid rain and haze in the gorge. NOx can also be a precursor to nitrous oxide, another greenhouse gas. Boardman also emits mercury, a potent neurotoxin that can impact early childhood development, and we support efforts to reduce this pollution as quickly as possible. Oregonians hold dear the environmental integrity of the state and deserve protection from climate change, air pollution, and other environmental threats. We're committed to working with PGE for an expedient and effective transition for Boardman. Thank you for the opportunity to present these views.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Costello. And really appreciate all three of you being here. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the report. It's extraordinarily interesting. Is there a study that you are, that's somewhere wrapped up in this, that shows us the overall economic impact of the closure? I note that in your report, you show that there will be a loss of 110 full-time employees or not, because I think you said maybe you'd quit burning coal there, maybe you'd start burning something else. I didn't quite follow that part of it. The other part, is there a study that shows us, or part of your work going to show us the impact of the increase in rates to jobs in Oregon? In other words, are we getting both the environmental side of this and also the economy side of it? And if so, if it's there, tell me, us, where we can find it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, yes, we've done, there are a couple different sets of analyses going on here. So what you've got are, we've got, I'll back up just a second here, you've got two different agencies with two different sets of standards. One is an environmental agency with environmental standards that we've got to meet for haze control. The other is a utility commission that has standards relative to least cost and least risk to electric customers in our service territory. So as part of those, what the agencies do as they look at the rule changes, there are a couple different sets of analyses that will look at pieces of the economic impact. The first is at the Utility Commission. In the Integrated Resource Plan, there will be an analysis of the costs and risks to customers of various options for closure of the Boardman plant, but also development of other resources, gas plants, renewables, etc. So those often will translate to some rough estimate of what the rate impact may be for various actions on customers. And a lot of times those rates aren't really set till the very year you're actually doing rates, so you don't know exactly what those will be, but we can do some estimates on that. And so those are somewhat known. The other on the economics, Representative Benz, that you mentioned was during the DEQ's process on the Hays Rule, what they can do is convene an economic task force that looks at economic impacts of their rules. I think that was a change to state agencies' rules, at least to this agency's rules, back from the 2005 session, possibly, where they have to move up an analysis of economic impacts. They had a work group that met several times during the last rule, and from what we've heard from the agency, they'll convene another work group that will look at economic impacts of on jobs in the area, on the cost of the pollution control equipment, and so those will be known as we move forward. For us, in terms of just PGE and the impacts of those workers on the plant, a lot of it depends on what type of replacement resources we put in place. So, for example, if we put a new natural gas-fired plant out in the Boardman area, as we're proposing, we're actually proposing one of those already in our resource plan. If we end up expanding that plant or putting another plant out there, for example, there are a number of workers that would find work at that plant. We've also got a number of new wind farms and other renewable projects going in to help meet the renewable energy standards, so there would be some opportunities for folks to take jobs there as well. So we're very concerned about our co-workers at that plant and making sure that they've got a smooth transition to whatever the new option would be. And we think that this 10-year time period, an additional 6 years beyond 2014, gives them that opportunity to make that transition.
It would be, on this jobs question, I mean, I don't see any projections showing that a total load decreases over time. It would be interesting to see sort of jobs per required per megawatt hour, whatever form of production that takes. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that kind of statistic before, but one would assume that if we're continuing to demand as much or more electricity as we are now, while sources of generation may change, jobs may in fact increase as demand increases, even if the sources are coming from other places. I don't know whether that's true or not, mm-hmm. but it would be interesting to look at that question that way. So just to be clear, closing in 2020, as you propose here, would mean not installing some of the very expensive pollution control technology that you would be required to install under the 2040 shutdown date, mm-hmm. and that you would be installing sooner. You would be installing in 2014, or at least ordering in 2014.
Second. Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we would do as far as pollution control equipment, we are proposing to install about, and I'll see if I have a slide here that I can show you. So if you take a look at slide number 10, I want you to just, there's a lot of numbers on here, but what I'd really like you to focus on are two sets of numbers. The first is the very bottom line on total cost. And so under the current rule, the amount of money it would cost to install all the equipment on the plant is about $500 million, a little over $500 million. So it says 510 right there. If what we're proposing on the right hand side is to go ahead and install a couple of sets of pollution control equipment that are relatively inexpensive compared to the big sets of equipment that we're talking about. So we are proposing to install new low NOx burners that would reduce NOx pollution by about 50% from the plant. We also proposed mercury control installation, which is a separate DEQ rule on mercury, which would reduce those emissions from the plant by 90%. So no matter what happens, we are proposing to install those controls. It's about $40 million, which is very economic for customers to go ahead and do that.
Dave, what type of analysis have you performed for closure options between 2014 and 2020? So we've seen 2014 versus 2020, 2020 versus 2040. What about an option between 2014 and 2020, say 2017?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, right now we've done some analysis of the different options that the DEQ has given us. So as Representative Cannon has suggested, we've done an analysis of 2014 closure, an analysis of 2040 closure, an analysis of a 2017 closure. If we, for example, installed half of the pollution control equipment on this chart, it's the line that says the scrubber bag house. If we installed that, we could operate till 2017 and decide not to install what is two lines below that, called the SCR, or selective catalytic reduction, which is another $180 million. That would be a 2017 closure, so we've analyzed that. And I think what a number of the interest groups are asking is, can we analyze some of those other dates in between 2014 and 2020, where it would be the same proposal. Only install the $40 million in controls, but go ahead and close it early. We have not done that analysis, but we are planning to do that. We've just sent some letters to several different groups that have asked us to look at that and let them know that we're going to analyze several dates between 2014 and 2020. We'll also analyze, just for symmetry's sake, several dates on the other side of 2020. So, for example, 2021, 2022, and 2023. So we can see how the economics move on either side of that date.
And to be clear, when you evaluate those dates between 2014 and 2020, will include one of the assumptions could be that you do not install the more expensive pollution control technology that you're proposing not to install for 2020. I would assume if it doesn't make sense to install for a 2020 closure, then it won't make sense to install it for a 2017 or 2015 closure either.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, that is correct. We would try to do an apples to apples comparison there. So the look would be for just the $40 million of equipment, nothing else,
right,
and then what the economics would be and the risk would be, because we do look at cost and risk. And the risk really talks about making sure we can keep the lights on in a real bad weather scenario, hot weather, cold weather, high gas prices, and other things that may happen. So, that would be all the same. We try to do apples to apples on that.
Great. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a curiosity point. All of these projections that you're presenting for us now are pretty much predicated on the assumption that there's no major breakthrough in the pollution control of coal-fired plants in this period of time. Is that correct, or has that even entered into the thinking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, we are factoring in that within the time period between now and 2020, there will be no viable, commercially available technology for carbon control. So what's really driving this is the fact that the long-term costs of greenhouse gas reduction or CO2 reduction from the plant are weighing economically in this equation, and that's really driving us to this cutting 20 years off the life of the plant and the 2020 closure. And part of the assumption in the next 10 years is, from all the analysis and studies that we've seen, there just won't be carbon capture technology ready by that time.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Jenks or Ms. Gaston, do you want to respond or comment on any of this discussion before we bring up the next set of questions?
I think Dave represented the sort of what they're looking at well. There is a degree, I mean, I know people want to look at different dates. There's a degree that this is sort of like your old car. Once you've paid off most of your car payments, if you can get a few more years out of that thing without major investment in it, that tends to be the cheapest. So I think we want to look at those dates. We want to poke at the numbers. We want to do that. But I do think the real good point about the PUC is it really is looking at sort of that analysis, and it's analytics driven, so we'll be able to see exactly what really is the least cost way to phase this plan out.
Great. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and apologize for missing the first part of the presentation, so perhaps this question was already asked. But for Mr. Robertson or Mr. Jenks, I'm curious, in looking at the first actual slide of the PowerPoint on expected growth in electricity needs through 2030, how sensitive is that assumption on load growth to the projection of load growth to the assumptions around energy efficiency, the cost of the technology, and the cost of the price of energy?
Yeah, that analysis is based. It's essentially based on what the what's currently in their IRP, their Integrated Resource Plan for Energy Efficiency. A lot of folks have heard about the Northwest Conservation and Power Council's new plan that includes a great deal more energy efficiency. This is greater than that. This is more than PG's share of that in terms of what we're expecting to get in the next 10 years. So it's pretty aggressive on energy efficiency. One of the things we want to have a dialogue in the IRP is how to. Well, what happens when you take Boardman out? What do you want to replace it with? And one of the real questions is, can we amp up energy efficiency more? Energy efficiency right now is the cheapest resource in that plan, and to the degree we can find ways to get more energy efficiency out of the system and as opposed to natural gas or even renewables, it will save customers money. So one of the things that will be looked at is how do we replace Boardman, and energy efficiency is the top of my list of what I want to look at.
Thank you. And am I correct in that the IRP has a five-year horizon on that?
The action plan, the IRP looks out 20 years, but the action plan, the sort of decisions that the PUC is really sort of approving or not, it's not really even approving, it's acknowledging or not, are really in the five-year action plan. So there's two parts of it. What decisions are really going to be made in the short term? In five-year lead time, you need that time for some actions. And then you look out 20 years to see how loads and resources will work. And because power plants and investments last that long, you want to look that long. So.
Great. Thanks very much to all three of you. Dave, you didn't say it, but this would be among the first, if not the first, closure of a baseload coal plant in the country. Is that right?
Yes, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. From the analysis that we've done, just looking at about a little shy of 500 coal plants nationwide. A number of them have several different units at them, different generating units, but about 500 plants. There have been several articles floating around over the last few months about early closure of some of those plants. But those have tended to be plants that are much older than the Boardman plant, that are from the 1950s era, but also are run on kind of a seasonal peak basis. They're very inefficient and only run in the winter when it's really cold or the summer when it's really hot, when they really need the power. Boardman is a base load plant. It's on almost all year except for scheduled maintenance or when something goes wrong. And so it is a solid, reliable workhorse type of a plant for us. And we think that just the fact that you're closing a base load plant makes things very interesting from a nationwide carbon reduction standpoint. If we are going to move towards significant carbon reduction in an orderly way, closing baseload plants is absolutely got to happen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robertson. There's lots more to talk about here, but we're out of time. Appreciate you all three being available today on relatively short notice, so thank you. We're going to move on and look at a little more broadly at greenhouse gas reduction strategies for the state, and in particular some of the opportunities and business opportunities related to those strategies. I'm going to start with the big picture from Mr. Duncan and Kathy Dello. Welcome. Angus, you want to kick us off here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and I chair the Oregon Global Warming Commission. And in a departure from what you usually hear when you come down to Salem, there's actually some good news to report. That's also a departure from what you usually hear when people say the word climate or climate change or climate disruption. In 2004, the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming recommended greenhouse gas reduction goals for 2010, 2020, and 2050. The legislature ratified those goals in 2007, and the advisory group had also recommended some 60 or so priority actions that they thought the state could begin to take to aim to reaching at least that first goal. In the report that our commission gave to the legislature last year, we reported happily that we were on track to meet our 2010 goal, which was to arrest the 1% per year creep in increase in greenhouse gas emissions from Oregon sources, to arrest that increase and to bend the line back downwards. And that's what we are even before the recession gave us a little boost, and that was always welcome, but recessions never last, lamentably. And so we have to assume that we are going to resume, and hopefully we're going to resume prosperity and growth in Oregon, but keep the line bending downwards. We achieved that because of work in the legislature to adopt a renewable portfolio standard, tailpipe standards, energy efficiency measures, recycling, and the much-abused Betsy, which certainly needed refocusing, but it is worth recognizing the boost that it gave to the development of renewable energy in Oregon. We also are achieving it because of actions at state and local, or at local government levels, City of Portland transportation, land use management work, in Newport, in Corvallis, in Klamath Falls, any number of communities have picked up this challenge and moved us forward to meeting our first goal. The next goal in 2020 is to reach deeply lower, to 10% below 1990 levels, which is roughly the equivalent of a 30% reduction from the emissions level we are at today. And we have to do that, you know, while growing our economy and while acknowledging that population will be growing as well. So what gets us to 2020? We would expect as a commission to report back to the legislature by the end of this year, to the next legislature and to the new governor, a roadmap to 2020, which we will try to build on the model of what was recommended to you back in 2004 by the advisory group, that will, we hope, serve as at least one or two or three scenarios for getting us to that 2020 goal. That roadmap will certainly include new technologies like electric vehicles, like smart grid systems that you'll hear about today. It will include national efficiency standards. It will include national action on capping carbon. It will certainly include figuring out how to back down on our reliance on gasoline for transportation and on conventional coal for generation. Boardman has to be the first step down that path. But for Oregon, there are two primary strategies. The first is to apply existing known technologies, practices, and financing tools, the stuff we already have in our toolkit, but apply those far more systematically, thoroughly, and proactively than heretofore. And the second strategy is to stop making it harder for the first strategy to work. Let me give you a couple of examples of these two strategies. The first one, the legislature passed Representative Bailey's East Bill last year, and at the same time, Portland and the Energy Trust deployed the first demonstration of really systematic, deep residential weatherization, their Clean Energy Works program. First one really since we did it in Hood River 30 years ago. 500 homes are getting treated in this first installment. That's walls and furnaces and hot water heaters, lighting, doors, setback thermostats, but calculated for a 20-year payback and calculated and financed with up to 20-year loans. We have to deploy this kind of strategy way beyond the first 500 homes. We have to deploy it in the community statewide, and we have to aim not at 20 or 30 or 50% market penetration, but at 90% plus market penetration. Those energy efficiency investments already are producing energy savings. They're producing carbon savings. They are producing energy dollars that we are not sending to Montana or to Wyoming for coal fuel, and they are producing sustainable family wage jobs. My house is just being finished this week under this program, and so far I have counted, I think, six different people who have shown up, two to do the walls, one to do the door, two to do the on-demand hot water heater, and one to do the testing. That's six people who are working on my house, and when they're done on my house, they're going to go to the next house. And we got to make sure when they get to the 500th house that there is another one right behind that. Second strategy, the example number two, is House Bill 2001 that this legislature passed also last year. It directed ODOT, among other things, to develop and apply least cost planning for transportation. Least cost planning is going to include valuing the carbon consequences of different scenarios.
ODOT has already developed, in collaboration with the Commission, its Green Step model that allows us to look at transportation and land use investments and choices and solve for greenhouse gas outcomes. At the same time, the legislature also locked in an earmark list of transportation projects for communities around the state. Many or most of these, maybe all of these, are good and useful projects. They are not necessarily least cost projects, either environmentally or economically. We have scarce transportation dollars to spend. If we are spending these on carbon increasing transportation projects, that's going to make meeting our 2020 goal that much harder. We're basically making a steep hill steeper, and we are also using up scarce transportation project dollars. So I would strongly encourage the legislature to revisit this issue, to direct ODOT to use its new least cost planning tools when they are available, to re-examine, you know, all of its projects, including this earmarked list, and to report back to the legislature on the greenhouse gas effects. Fundamentally, we have to stop thinking, you know, in compartmentalized thought patterns. We can't deal with climate issues in this box over here and deal with business as usual in that one over there.
Thank you very much, Angus. Sure. And let's hear from Ms. Dello, and then we'll see if there are questions. And is this your first time?
It is the first
Oregon Legislature. Well, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Cannon and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you the progress of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute thus far, primarily our progress on Section 15.3 of HB 3453, the assessment of the state of climate science as it pertains to Oregon. My name is Kathy Dello. I am a faculty research assistant with OCRI. House Bill 3543 established the institute in 2007, which is housed at Oregon State University in the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences. We started work in 2009 with the hiring of Director Philip Moat and have been ramping up our efforts in addressing climate change in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest quite rapidly. We've been involved in a number of state and federally funded projects. The legislation charged us with a number of tasks to address climate change in the state, which we accomplished by drawing from in-house and OUS faculty expertise. We refer to ourselves as Oregon's Climate Knowledge Network. Our faculty number over 100 and are located across four campuses and span numerous disciplines. The ability to successfully facilitate cross-disciplinary climate research has made us successful in a number of recent proposals. The primary function of OCRI is to support stakeholders as they are forced to make decisions under various degrees of uncertainty. Per the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we know that the climate is indeed changing. Two key findings arose from this report. One, that warming is unequivocal. We haven't experienced a warming as significant and of this magnitude in our Earth's record. Two, that the observed change is very likely due to anthropogenic activity, mostly from the burning of greenhouse gases. The IPCC defines very likely as a 90% confidence level. We know a lot about climate change on the global scale, but not at the societally relevant regional scale. So closer to home, Phil Moat and Eric Salate at University of Washington did an analysis of 20 general circulation models. These GCMs, or climate models, all show an increase in annual temperature by the end of the century for the Pacific Northwest under a fossil fuel intensive scenario, or what the IPCC calls A1B. That's not to say that this analysis comes without a range of uncertainty. The range of projected temperatures goes from a couple of degrees to quite large, almost 9 degrees Fahrenheit at the end of the century. The average temperature increase from all the models is about 6 degrees Fahrenheit by 2080. Many of the models don't show a clear picture of what will happen with annual precipitation, though many models show seasonal changes. In particular, they show drier summers and wetter winters. What these changes could mean for our resources: a decreased snowpack, changing hydrology, increased incidence of forest fires and insect outbreaks, and sea level rise, where the overall rise is greater than the vertical land movement. We started to notice changes in our hydrology already. In the Journal of Science, Barnett et al. Found that up to 60% of the climate-related trends of river flow, winter air temperature, and snowpack in the western U.S. in the latter half of the 20th century are human-induced. The legislation tasked us with writing an assessment of the state of the climate science at least once each biennium, including biological, physical, and social science, as it relates to Oregon and the likely effects of climate change on the state. We will release our inaugural report on September 30th of this year. Oregon will become the sixth state to compile such a report. Drawing from our pool of cross-disciplinary faculty and researchers in state and federal agencies in Oregon, we established a report outline, recruited lead authors for each section, and we're on pace to receive the first draft from our lead authors on March 1st. We've strived to be transparent with the assessment effort, engaging the legislature, state agencies, and university faculty to join us in assembling this report. We established the Blue Ribbon Panel, consisting of Chairman Cannon, Senator Dingfelder, Mark Abbott, the Dean of COAS, and Gail Achterman, Director of INR at OSU, to help inform the process, from approving the outline and agreeing to read drafts to offering comments and attending our writers' meeting. Their presence at this meeting will ensure that we're providing a product that not only addresses the legislation, but will be a useful tool in the decision-making process. After consulting with the Blue Ribbon Panel, we came up with a timeline that has us delivering the report in September and has plenty of time for peer review and revisions. We won't be releasing the draft report for public review, but we'll distribute a draft to a broad audience of experts and stakeholders to offer feedback and comments. Our report consists of the following chapters and lead authors: climate science by Phil Moat, director of OCRI; the drivers of emissions with lead author Aslam Khalil, who is faculty at Portland State; water with lead author Heejun Chang, also faculty at Portland State; fish, wildlife, and marine resources with lead author Mark Hickson at Oregon State; forests and rangelands with lead author Sarah Schaefer of the U.S. Geological Survey; agriculture with Greg Jones of Southern Oregon University; and coastal impacts with lead author Peter Ruggiero of Oregon State; economics with Susan Capalbo of Oregon State; and human dimensions with lead author Denise Locke of Oregon State. These lead authors have recruited dozens of faculty and researchers from state and federal agencies to help write their chapters. Each chapter highlights the relevant climate change research from our faculty and agency staff in their disciplines. The lead authors, the Blue Ribbon Panel, and a state representative from the state adaptation effort will meet later this month to discuss the draft report and identify any crucial gaps in the narrative. Connecting data to decisions has become one of the focuses of OCRI, and we've attempted to make the science accessible to decision makers. The phrase increase in temperature alone doesn't provide a compelling case for action for many of our stakeholders, while the impacts of an increase in temperature, such as changing species distributions, does. As a result, we've aligned with the parallel state adaptation effort, using the best available science to inform their process and integrating the need of the state agencies to have clear, compelling, and concise information from the experts in our assessment report. The need to address uncertainties and establish priorities, both spatial and temporal, to what we know as likely effects of climate change has come up in the discussions, and the lead authors will address this issue later this month at the writers' retreat. We look forward to releasing what we think is a comprehensive assessment of the state of the science as it pertains to Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I'll see if there are questions from members of the committee. Seeing none, I think we'll release you to appreciate hearing about the work of the Institute. Look forward to seeing a draft of the report, and know that it will be valuable as this legislature and other stakeholders plan on moving forward. So thank you for your work and for the update. Thank you, Angus. And let's bring up the next panel: Gail Achterman, Robert Frisbee, George Beard, Wayne Embry.
Can we have 2 seconds to get the
yeah.
computer?
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll stand at ease for just a moment.
How many of us are there?
Well, there are four in this panel, so we can have one sort of on deck.
No, but that's we can.
Or we
all
can
four
squeeze
of us can get up there.
Four of you together.
I'm petite.
You're standing at ease.
I think we are standing at ease, and just so folks know, we're at that point in the session where things change rapidly.
So,
we appreciate that.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Gail Achterman. I am the director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University and the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission, and I really come here with both hats on to address the topic of reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. I'm going to be very brief this morning, and I think you're going to learn a lot more about the opportunities that are presented for economic development and diversification from the other panelists. But the basic facts of the matter are shown on two pie charts that are attached to my testimony, which show that about a third of greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon come from the transportation sector, and about 60% of those, or 20% of the total, are from light vehicles. They're from light trucks and automobiles. And so if we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we're going to have to address emissions from the transportation sector. So that's point number one. Point number two is that in order
to... Hang on a sec, Gail. Representative Jensen, you have a question?
Yes, sir.
Quick note. Wouldn't one of the quickest and fastest ways to remove or to lower this be to pass this law with 55-mile-an-hour speed limit?
Yes. Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, thank you for mentioning one of my most favorite topics. Yes, Representative Jensen made a very important point, which simply by lowering the speed limit, which would also save lots of lives, which we also ought to all care about, we could also save a lot of fuel. And you may have read the article, I'm not sure where I read it in recently, but Maersk, one of the major international steamship lines, has actually shifted to slowing the speeds on all of their ships internationally in order to save money and reduce carbon emissions. So,
You mean we'd actually save money while also saving greenhouse gas?
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, yes, sir. So, if you want to tackle greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, it is challenging. It's more challenging, actually, than the energy sector because there are more diverse players. It's a more complex and unregulated system compared to the energy sector. But there are things we can do, and we need to do them systematically. I think it's extremely useful to look at four strategy approaches, all of which have to be pursued in a systematic way if we're going to take advantage of the opportunities and actually achieve the reductions. The first is we can switch to low carbon fuels, whether it's biofuels or electric vehicles, we can shift to low carbon fuels. The second is that we can shift to using cleaner, more efficient vehicles. So whether that's an electric vehicle or whether that's a streamlined truck, like Freightliner is now making in Portland, you can get significant efficiencies by improving the aerodynamics and essentially the efficiency of the vehicle. Most of us don't realize, but an internal combustion engine, I think it's something like 40% of the energy is completely lost through heat. They're very inefficient engines compared to an electric motor. The third, so you've got heat recapture that could improve efficiencies. The third area is to reduce vehicle miles traveled. And I like to really say this, not necessarily reducing vehicle miles traveled, but get the right vehicles miles traveled for people. It's much more important that an ambulance get to the hospital than it is for me to run to a coffee shop for a latte on the spur of the moment in terms of social well-being. But if we reduce and target vehicles miles traveled, and in the freight sector, if we switch modes so that we could revitalize our rail infrastructure system, which has much less GHG impact than trucks, or we can shift from rail to marine, revitalizing our barge system, particularly on the Columbia Snake system, those all have GHG emission effects. And the fourth, and this is often not emphasized sufficiently, is to optimize the efficiency and operation of the existing system, which reduces congestion, so you don't have all these vehicles sitting around emitting greenhouse gases while they aren't going anywhere. And obviously that has other significant societal benefits. There is a reference at the very bottom of the back page of my testimony to something called a mind map. And those of you who are really interested in fun new computer toys, Brian Greger, who it's not there.
No, it's too much. It was too big.
No, the link.
Oh, the link.
The link is there. The mind map was too complicated, so we didn't attach it. But if you want to play around with a really great analytical tool to help you think about what you could do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, this is a real cool tool that Brian Greger from our planning staff has developed. The systems approach is vital. The other thing we need to think about is the time to impact. So we've got to provide people and shippers these choices, which ones are going to make the most difference first. And Representative Jensen hit on one of them. If we all just chose to drive slower, we'd have a huge effect. Land use transportation integration takes a lot longer. We've been at it for 35 years in Oregon, and we're way ahead of the rest of the country, but we don't change the way our communities are designed overnight. We don't build new light rail lines overnight. So you've got to look at time to implementation on all of these choices, which is why it's really important to look at greenhouse gas emission reduction strategies in the transportation sector programmatically at a planning level, so you can make smart decisions. And I'm running out of time.
You are running out of time.
ODOT is doing a lot in this area. It's described in my written testimony. If you want to know more, this is the book to read. I will give it to your clerk, and she can write down the full title, and we can turn to the other panelists.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ackerman. Who's next? You decide.
Robert Frisbee from Smart Grid Oregon. Can the committee assistant direct me on bringing this up on the screen? Because I do have a truly astounding PowerPoint technology for you. Great, thank you. Let's see. And now I'm looking for the expand. This is a new...
they changed that.
A new format here.
It's a.
You know, I can do without. My name is Robert Frisbee. I'm here representing Smart Grid Oregon. You might say, who the heck is Smart Grid Oregon? It is a new organization that's been formed by a group of people involved in the industry to promote Smart Grid. Smart Grid is the enhancement of the electrical delivery generation and use system with information technologies. I've been trying to think of the right analogy, and I thought it's the cream with your coffee, it's the frosting with your cake. No, I think it's the mortar with your bricks that best describes Smart Grid. Smart Grid in and of itself is not a solution. It is, however, a very important piece of making every other piece of the solution more effective. It is also an area where we believe Oregon can be a leader. And in this fast-changing energy space, we think it's important that Oregon carve out a position. Now, so you look in the current, where is the smart grid in our current environment? Well, we have had a very effective and robust command and control system that has delivered energy throughout the 120 years or so that there has been energy delivered over the power system. It goes all the way from centralized power generation, transmission, distribution, measurement, until it's delivered and used by the customer. But this has been a very one-way delivery system. It has been a hammer and tong system of physical delivery with only a modest information component. But there are very important things that are changing that will force the change in how that system is administered. And it's something that this committee deals with on an ongoing basis. Centralized hydro, nuclear, and coal is now increasing to add significant wind, solar, geothermal, hydrokinetic, otherwise known as wave and current, biomass, and additional natural gas. The roles that power has to play are expanding. Baseline power, intermittent power, and this is one of the key elements, is that much renewable energy flows on an intermittent basis. There is the leveling power needed to even that out, because it does not reflect consumption. There's the peaking power, and the big shift from a very centralized system to a distributed generation system, and the backup required to make that reliable. Key technologies are expanding rapidly to fill the voids needed. Efficiency, conservation, storage, microgrids, demand management, distributed generation are all elements in the solution. And I think one of the things you face every hearing you have is realizing that there isn't a silver bullet to all of this. It will be a solution of many piece parts, and Smart Grid helps weld those together. These technologies bring on new challenges. Load balancing becomes critical, balancing renewables with reliability. And for most of the new power sources, this will be a policy issue that the Oregon legislature will face, that the PUC will face, that the national bodies will face. As you increase intermittent power, the reliability of the system will face new challenges. Pricing is going to be a critical element. We have in the past largely based pricing on long-term depreciated costs, but now we have to look to the future and future demand. Oregon has the tricky setting of having some of the of relatively low-priced historical power and relatively high-priced additional power. So this is, as we look at economic development requirements and sandwich those with carbon reduction needs, this pricing issue, sending the right signals into the marketplace and the right signals to investors, is going to be key. And then there is educating and informing users, voters, and the general public. So this becomes some key issues: centralized versus distributed systems, levelized versus variable sources of energy. We have new international pressures with key players like China having a very focused national policy with huge investment behind it. There are no more easy additions to power sources, and this is something that you face every time you sit at the dais. We will see new levels of participation by a broad range of players, particularly consumers, and this will require major changes in the system. And it means that the state of Oregon must play a leadership role in carving out the energy future for our citizens, particularly as we balance economic growth and the need for reduction in carbon. And, of course, these climate issues change the rules significantly. So, how does the smart grid play a role? Number one, it overlays the energy network with an information network. It provides information, distributed command and control, security, and efficiency capture for a new distributed environment. It allows Oregon to capitalize on its resources, and Oregon has very diverse resources. You think about our power sources. Since we have mountains and rain, we have hydro. Since we have two-thirds of the state, which is relatively dry and sunny, we have solar. The geography produces wind. We have wave. And we have an independent and innovative mindset to our citizens, be they farmers who know how to squeeze the dollar out of spent on irrigation, pumping irrigation water, or urbanites looking to move to electric vehicles. We have an innovative culture here. And these, through Smart Grid, can provide tools to meet our economic and climate goals. So Smart Grid can play this role on the production side of coordinating a very diverse range of sources, particularly distributed sources. So as we see people putting up solar panels in eastern Oregon, believe it or not, people putting up solar panels here in western Oregon, we see distributed wind. We see the potential of storage. People are using electric cars, as an example, as a storage device to sell power back into the grid. We see a very excellent outcome, I believe, from the legislature's work on a feed-in tariff. that provides very good guidance for how variable pricing can prepare Oregon and put Oregon into a leadership position. Transmission is a critical item that Smart Grid contributes to. Distribution, measurement, and uses and sources. The enablement of consumers to have power and participation in their energy use is critical. And the feedback of information through the Smart Grid and the provision of control capabilities increases their ability to reduce their energy bills.
And Mr. Frisbee, if you could finish up in the next minute or so.
Smart Grid can reduce 20% efficiencies in consumption if combined with effective price signals and has a number of other very positive effects on all the solutions. So how does a body like the Oregon Legislature make Oregon a leader in Smart Grid? Number one, a strategic energy plan for Oregon is a key element. The legislature has been forward-looking, for instance, in kinetic power to produce a strategic plan, and that is needed here. Second, renewable and energy efficiencies are critical to a successful Smart Grid. The Betsy was a first step, but there are paths beyond Betsy that can continue Oregon's effectiveness here. The feed-in tariff has been a successful pilot and should be expanded. There are regulations, both at the state and the federal level, which without legislation and without additional cost can enhance the outcome for Oregon Energy. Creating paths for investors to invest in efficiency is a key part for Oregon. East did a good job of moving that forward, but there are other ways that are required to make that a scalable solution. Where additional generation is needed, transmission and energy siting at the state level and at the federal level is going to be key. The Smart Grid Oregon has a full list of legislative priorities, which I would be glad to share with any of you. So those are the policies that we advocate. Also, I want to say that the organization is here to help. We follow the Oregon Legislature closely and feel it has played a very forward-looking role in the energy future, and we look forward to the ability to support your efforts in this space.
Thank you very much. Mr. Embry.
I'm not Wayne.
I'm sorry.
George Beard.
Go ahead, Mr. Beard.
Chairman Cannon, members of the committee, I presume that you want to get this wrapped in about 4 minutes or so.
Well, we are going to go past 9:30 with the hearing, although we will lose some members at that point.
I'll be as economical as I can.
Thank you
for the opportunity to appear before you. What I'd like to do is, kind of in the David Letterman sense of the word, give you five things that you may be interested in knowing about electric vehicles. The first one is that this time frame, 2010-2011, will be a breakout year for Oregon. And you'll begin to see the appearance of infrastructure and vehicles arrive on the scene and be deployed not only in fleets but also made available to the consumer marketplace. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. The second point I guess I'd like to make is Trump's statement that Gail Ackerman made to you about time of impact, that it takes years sometimes to achieve a transition or a shift. And in the particular case of adopting and introducing and deploying electric vehicles, I would submit to you that there's a useful model that you might think about. If you drew a circle on a piece of paper and divided it by a north, south, and east-west axis. In other words, you divided that circle into four quadrants. One of the key elements is infrastructure, the charging units that will be necessary to support this. Secondly is the introduction of vehicles. I'll highlight that briefly. The third is the alignment of policies and practices that promote the new way of transportation and the new way of operating that becomes very important. And finally, and I would argue most importantly, that public opinion and public awareness becomes the key enabler. So we can build infrastructure and have cars, but if the public's not informed and not motivated or not incented, then the adoption of the, this new desired method will be impeded, to be sure. Here's the third thing I'd like you to know. Oregon is on the beneficiary side of a very substantial federal U.S. Department of Energy grant. The grantee is a company called ETEC based out of Arizona. Oregon is one of five test markets that's been chosen to deploy on the neighborhood in aggregate of 2,200 charging stations. Most of the public ones will be built in the next years. And the four market areas are obviously Portland, Salem, Corvallis, and Eugene, and the immediate surrounding areas. So you're going to see charging infrastructure popping up in a really significant way here. Again, though, I would argue that this is as much a matter, maybe more, of social innovation than it is about physical infrastructure. Two final points to you. The vehicles that will be coming into Oregon and elsewhere, into North America in the next 3 to 5 years, are principally going to be of these types. There are battery electric vehicles, battery only, 100% propelled by motors and batteries. Think of the family sedan that can go about 100 miles. That's type number one. Type number two is your, if you think about a Prius, there's a plug-in Prius, plug-in hybrid vehicles that will be coming out and made available to consumers. The third one is an extended range vehicle that's like a Chevy Volt that has a 40-mile range, but has an engine that can generate additional power and can go 240 miles. That's a different strategy. And then even within Oregon, there's a number of companies that are producing lighter weight, lighter utility vehicles, some of which are characterized as neighborhood electric vehicles, and you'll see those. They're more than golf carts. They're bona fide and well-engineered vehicles, but you'll be seeing those as well. So four vehicle types, in addition to electric bicycles and electric motorcycles and so forth. But those platforms for moving people will be significant. The economics on this remains a bit uncertain. The initial price points on the cars that we know about that are coming into Oregon this year looks like they'll be priced in the $30,000 to $40,000 range. The federal incentives, tax incentives, make those, I believe there's a $7,500 federal tax credit. The existence of Betsy and Retsy and similar state incentives, to the extent that they can be made available, help the economics. But in any event, that's both a barrier, and at the moment, that's what the price points are going to be on these vehicles. And finally, if you'd like to learn more about it, there's a pretty simple and still evolving website that's trying to tell the Oregon story. It is EV Roadmap. EV stands for electric vehicle. EVroadmap.com. And I wish I could tell you more, but time's not our friend.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you keeping it brief. Mr. Embry.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. In front of you, you have a 8.5 by 11, two pieces of paper stapled together. It says smart grid opportunities. I'll be, having formerly worked for this body, I'll be pathologically brief.
Will you introduce yourself as well?
Wayne Embry, managing partner, Reference Capital Management. We're a seed stage venture fund that has been investing in the energy and environmental sector for the last 25 years. The first page underlines, I think, one of the basic premises we have to understand when we start looking at relatively large scale and even incremental changes in the electric infrastructure. The fact of the matter is the global energy production environment we currently have will be what we probably have 20 years from now. There'll be nuances around the edges, but we'll be pretty much generating power from the existing sources we're generating power from now. There's no question that the electric infrastructure needs a lot of help, but it's constrained by regulatory environments. It's constrained by the utility infrastructure, sunk costs, NIMBY and BANANA. If you're all familiar with
BANANA.
Representative Cannon, Representative Boone, BANANA has built absolutely nothing near anyone at any time. And then finally, one of the things that was highlighted by both Gail Ackerman and Mr. Frisbee is the transitional technologies. The reality is we will get where we want to go, but it's going to be a series of increments. Actually, Oregon has a number of examples of that. Some of the things that Angus Duncan talked about, we've really done more than just experimental attempts to understand the relationship between consumers and the use of electric utilities. And to that end, the second page is a diagram describing what an intelligent infrastructure actually looks like. All this has been described already, but the key thing is all of this has to interact together. And one of the things that's been missing from the discussion, with the exception of describing as it relates to hydro, is water management. It's one of the key issues of this committee, I know, and that's we can't forget that, because frankly, water is a bigger issue than oil. It's one of the things that's going to drive immigration to Oregon and the Northwest over the next several years. So one of the things I would urge the committee is, when you're looking at policies and procedures going forward, is to look at those things which will be broad in nature and less specific. So instead of trying to identify winners, so we can avoid things like the ethanol debacle we had over the last couple of years, and focus on broader policy initiatives. And one that comes specifically to mind is working with the other states within the region, within the Bonneville service area, to find a coordinated, harmonized regulatory environment. Not that I'm carrying water for the utilities here, but the reality is it will make the implementation of a lot of these new technologies and processes far easier if the service territory has a harmonized policy and regulatory approach, as opposed to the utilities having to go and fight the battles of every single state and a different PUC and a different regulatory environment.
Thanks. Appreciate those remarks, and that brings up, opens up a big subject with your last comments related to the regulatory environment for utilities in the region. When you look, you take the broad view and look at the variety of approaches that would build an intelligent infrastructure, is it possible to quickly give a sense of what the primary regulatory barriers are? And I know you're probably engaged in this as well, all three of you, to building this, what you've called an intelligent infrastructure.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I think the fundamental one really has to do with siting, harmonization of the renewable energy standards, and then also what are the various economic cases that the utilities have to make, because every time they go to a different public utility commission, they have literally a different rate case process they have to go through. I think a good example of this is, over the last year, four major transmission projects around the country have been abandoned. The reality is, the way we're trying to build renewables is, in some respects, we're mimicking what we've done with large centralized power plants. We're building large, they may not look like they're centralized, but large renewable energy plants, but we have to move that energy some way. And so in many cases that requires building new transmission lines. It's been very difficult to get those new transmission lines approved.
Thanks. Did you want to add anything?
Robert Frisbee.
Yeah.
This area, as you look at China with a single unified energy policy and the United States with 50 different bodies carving out all the rules, is very difficult. But also, you have to do things you can do, and changing the entire national PUC structure, which is the best solution, is unlikely. I think I concur on transmission. It is a critical item to make everything else work. The other element is, I think the time frame for PUC consideration is important. I think a 30-year planning horizon for the PUC to look at their issues would significantly improve the outcome. Currently, they are limited to relatively short-term issues, and I think they do a good job, but the ability to look longer-term and look at these long-term supply and pricing issues, I think, would help the state, help the legislature look at the key issues. So that's a practical step I would propose.
Great. Thanks very much. I appreciate the three of you being here, and I expect you'll be in committee, Senate committee, later in the morning. Great.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll bring up the last panel, Sergio Diaz and John Volkman. There are only two of us up here, but I assure you we have a vast listening and watching audience all across the globe. So, in any order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone. My name is John Volkman from the Energy Trust of Oregon. I'm going to go first. I do have a PowerPoint, but I think I can probably go through my points quickly, and if you want something in writing, the PowerPoint can be printed out.
Well, I think that we'll see if we can bring it up here.
I don't know where it is. Let you do this, and I'll just start talking.
Thanks.
First of all, energy efficiency is a major resource in the Northwest. One of the slides in the presentation.
Could you introduce yourself?
John Volkman from the Energy Trust of Oregon. I'm general counsel there, so I'm not a technical person, but I understand the English language translation of the technical stuff. Northwest plans investment, according to the Northwest Power Planning Council's analyses, on the order of 1,200 average megawatts over the next 5 years. So that's a regional number. 1,200 average megawatts is, say, four or so coal plants. It's a big planned resource over 5 years. And investment in energy efficiency is expected to double, possibly triple over 5 years. So the interest in investing in energy efficiency is growing by leaps and bounds. And planners think that we can meet something like 85% of the load growth through energy efficiency at that level of investment. The reason it's growing so fast is it is such a bargain. The cost of energy efficiency is about one-third to one-fourth the cost of building generation resources and new power plants. So it's cost us about 2 cents a kilowatt hour compared to 8 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour for new generation. It's very attractive to consumers if they understand the deal. They save 20% or more on their utility bills. So it not only saves them money, it increases comfort, it has lots of other values, makes businesses more competitive. The societal benefits are also increasingly important with greenhouse gas regulation somewhere down the pike, but the concern growing. Energy efficiency contributes to healthier environment. So societally, it's a good thing to do. The legislature has a number of levers it can use to make energy efficiency happen. It controls tax credits, as we know from the Betsy debate this session. It controls codes and building standards, appliance standards. The legislature has authorized loan programs. And you have also authorized a public purpose fund, which is what Energy Trust is about. The public purpose fund started out as a 3% charge on electric rates for investor-owned utilities. It now has expanded to gas utilities through contracts with Energy Trust. We now have a very large-scale energy conservation program in Oregon, transcends electric and gas. Energy Trust service territories now span most of the state, serves about 80% of Oregon energy consumers, two gas utilities, two electric utilities. So it's a much bigger program than it began as. At this point, we have programs covering the residential sector, the commercial sector, the industrial sector. These, unlike codes and other devices you have available to you, are persuasive programs. So we are trying to persuade people to act through education, through technical assistance, and by providing enough financial assistance to them that they are moved to make their own investments in energy efficiency, which after all are going to save them money. So with those kinds of tools, since 2002, we've saved about 285 average megawatts of electricity and almost 9 million therms. We can translate those into numbers of houses and energy use and other factors. But it's, again, it's about the size of a coal plant, a good-sized coal plant. The economic value of those investments, since 2002, we've saved Oregon ratepayers $440 million. That's money that's gone back into their pockets instead of into energy costs. 1,800 new jobs, $60 million in wages, and $9 million in new business investment. There are about 1,200 contractors Energy Trust works with to implement all these measures, and those 1,200 small businesses are beneficiaries. So looking ahead over the coming 5 years, we think we need to ramp up our programs, double, possibly triple the output of our programs if we can do it. That would give us, bring us about another 256 average megawatts over 5 years, which is a much faster pace than the past. The net benefit, the net economic benefit that we see in delivering that kind of energy savings is a little more than $1 billion in savings. So that's a gigantic economic benefit. On the gas side, the benefits are not quite as large, but we're looking at $72, $73 million worth of net economic benefit from those programs over 5 years. If we do all that, it depends on how much energy load grows, but if growth is in the medium range, energy load grows in the medium load growth range that the Power Planning Council outlines, we think that our energy efficiency programs can meet that growth. So Oregon load growth would be covered by our electric efficiency programs. If growth is much higher, as PGE is projecting, then we can't cover all that at these levels of investment. But at medium growth, we believe we can. And that's all I have.
Thank you very much. And just to clarify, you believe that under this medium growth scenario, with a doubling or tripling of investment, you could meet the load growth through energy efficiency?
Yes.
Okay. Not at current levels of investment.
Well, we just got a big bump in our funding from the utilities through the PUC's integrated resource planning process. Our budget is going up, we think, to achieve those levels of investment.
Under the Senate Bill 838 provisions that allow that go beyond the 3%.
Yes, and the gas companies are keeping pace with that too. Okay.
So what is it now? I mean, it was 3% initially, then we created this option for the utilities to go for more. What are you looking at now, roughly?
I think in 2010, the budget for efficiency programs is on the order of $120 million a year.
And as it appears on ratepayers, IOU ratepayer bills, how does that, again, it was 3%, just to get a sense of the growth. So I heard roughly 5. I mean, it differs by utility, but what is there a...
You know, I don't think I can tell you. This is where my mind, being a non-technical person, is a disadvantage.
Thanks.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Mr. Diaz.
Thank you. My name is Sergio Diaz, and I own a small consulting firm that focuses on industrial energy efficiency strategies. And today I wanted to talk a little bit about energy efficiency and primarily to talk about industrial energy efficiency. I wanted to primarily leave you with the idea that although the state of Oregon has some great programs for industrial energy efficiency, like the Business Energy Tax Credit and the Oregon and the Energy Trust of Oregon, that things are changing pretty quickly in the industrial sector, and the state will need to really reevaluate its role, its purpose, if it wants industry to get to where it needs to for climate change and energy issues. I first wanted to give you a little bit of context, and this is some of the context that I've been working with industrial groups with on. There's a sense that energy has this perfect storm. There's three pretty big elements at work that are making energy and energy efficiency issues become prevalent. The first is that at an ever-increasing rates, homes, businesses, and industry is dependent on energy. Homes are adding plasma TVs, electric toothbrushes. They're electrifying pretty much everything we do. We're adding computers, monitors, more televisions. Businesses are doing the same thing. They're adding servers, electric controls, and industry is pretty quickly automating some of their processes. So many times replacing people with automated equipment, equipment that might look at the quality of foods, products, versus using people to do that. So what you're seeing is on a per capita basis, people are dependent much more and more on electricity and on energy. At the same time, the region is growing at a pretty consistent rate. From 1985 to 2007, the Northwest grew by about 40%, and the projection is that growth will continue through 2030. So what you're also seeing is that while people are depending much more on energy, there's also a huge growth in the number of people using that energy. So you've seen through some of the presentations what that's doing to some of the resource plans. To complete the picture, that the energy consumption is what's primarily causing the CO2 emissions. So there's this sense that that we've got to do something to find alternate resources. So traditional resources like hydro aren't an option for creating new options. Nuclear isn't an option, and CO2 intensive energy sources aren't an option either, which puts out coal and natural gas. So those three things combined are giving really a sense of urgency to the region, to the state, to the nation, really. And with that context, industry is really starting to look at what is their role in energy and energy efficiency. They're starting to question the assumptions that they made. Much of industry moved out to the Northwest when energy was cheap, it was available, it was primarily hydro. And although they were far from their markets, primarily in the East Coast, the low energy prices and the availability of it made it so that they would locate in the Northwest and have that as a strategic advantage and overcome the cost of transporting their product back to the East Coast. So with that context, industry starting to look at what can they do to be involved in the energy equation, and how can they change the discussion so it's not about it's not approached in the same way that it was in the past. In the past, programs were pretty straightforward. There was a sense that you change the equipment that consumes energy and you save energy. You give someone a financial incentive to change that equipment, you lower their payback, and that's really what causes, the idea was that businesses are financial animals. You lower their payback to 2 years, how could they pass that up? They've got to act. And so industry's role was primarily to wait until there was incentive levels that were low enough where the ROI was there, and then they could act upon programs that were being brought to them by different entities. But that view really ignores the group dynamics of industry, and it also ignores industry's needs and any industry-specific nuances. It ignores how a company functions, their management practices, their employees, their marketing needs, and the role of their executives. And it also ignores the internal needs for something like energy efficiency, the competitiveness, the cost-cutting, capitalization, access to capital, employee training, innovation. Those are really some of the issues that are starting to drive companies to adopt energy efficiency. And they're starting to look at it as a different, an internal paradigm as to how can I survive and how can energy efficiency be a component of my strategy for survival. So it's starting to change their paradigm that they're starting to look at, rather than looking at it as a financial perspective, how can I look at it as a holistic endeavor on my company's side. Some of the recent trends in the region are starting to show that industry's need for energy efficiency is as important as the electric or natural gas utility need for energy efficiency. The Northwest Food Processors Association, who I've worked with for the past 4 years, and I'm proud to say is one group that looked at that equation and realized that they had to do something proactive about it. Through their annual surveys, the NWFPA surveys their executives, and for the past 7 years, energy has been one of their top issues. This past year, the association decided that it was time for them to take action. The way they did that was by setting their own targets, their own goals. They set a target to reduce their energy consumption by 25% over 10 years and 50% over 20 years. Now they're looking at the comprehensive programs that allow them to reach that goal. They're looking at management training, process innovation, management best practices, new technologies, executive level outreach, renewable energy, and they're looking at building broad comprehensive partnerships that will allow them to launch those programs. In other words, they really looked at what would it take for their industry to become energy efficient in a more holistic process. The need for industrial energy efficiency and the internal need for it also has driven companies to attend things like the Industrial Energy Efficiency Summit, which was held in Portland last month. At that summit, we brought together primarily industry folks, but also government, electric and gas utilities, and consultants to discuss for a full day what would be the top five actions that would drive industrial energy efficiency in the state of Oregon. And their top five actions weren't necessarily about incentives. They weren't about technologies. But they were rather a call to action to look at energy efficiency more broadly. Their top response was that energy efficiency programs needed to focus not just on equipment, but also on systems, technical systems, management systems, things like lean, how you incorporate energy efficiency into lean, energy management, ISO 50001s. What they really asked for was a broader look at the definition of energy efficiency that went beyond pumps, motors, and equipment. They also asked for better coordination between all the different entities that exist. They recognize that Energy Trust has a good program, BPA has a good program, Betsy's a good program, but they said it's difficult to find out what all those entities are doing for us. It's difficult to coordinate the paperwork for them all. It's difficult to understand the limits between one and another. They really said there should be a way that we have access to that information so we don't have to go to each individual website, to each individual program to figure that out, but so that it's easy to find, and also so that the paperwork is easy for us to fill out. So it's probably consistent. It allows one-stop shopping. We can fill out one piece of paperwork that has the similar information for all the programs.
I have to ask you to finish up, too, since we're due on the floor in a couple of minutes.
Sure. And the last thing they asked is that they, as an industry, create a mechanism to share information with each other. If I'm doing energy efficiency in my facility, there's no reason why I wouldn't share that with another facility. If I installed a variable frequency drive and had issues with it, there's no reason why I shouldn't share that with another manufacturer. So the definition of energy efficiency is really has been primarily short-sighted and looked at to reach energy efficiency goals, to reach kilowatt-hour goals, not necessarily to serve industry in a way that they feel like they need to be served. So that really is what I wanted to leave you with, is just the idea that as the legislation starts looking at the role of the state to look at some of those gaps in that, and not just focus on the financial side of it, but to look at the role the governor could have in setting up discussions with executives, the role that the Oregon Department of Energy could have in helping coordinate different entities that work on behalf of industry, and to start looking at it from a different paradigm and from a different perspective. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. Yeah, Representative Boone.
A comment. Yeah, so I guess what I'm hearing then is if we make policy that urges collaboration and coordination, it will be accepted.
I believe so. I believe it will be accepted and supported.
Yeah. Thanks.
Appreciate that. Thanks. Well, thank you very much for being here, and we'll look forward to hearing more about this subject during the interim and in the next session. With that, I'll close the informational hearing and close the House Committee on Environment and Water.